Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Craig Servillo, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Despina Stratagakos about her excellent new book, Hitler's Northern Utopia, Building the New Order in Occupied Norway. Hi, Despina. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me to the New Books Network.
It's a pleasure to have you. We always like to begin these interviews by having the authors tell us a little bit about themselves. So why don't we go ahead and do that now?
So I am a professor in the School of Architecture and Planning at the University at Buffalo and UB's Vice Provost for Inclusive Excellence. I am also an architectural historian who is drawn to stories that don't tend to appear in mainstream history books. I've written about the histories of women in architecture and their role as city builders. I've also written about unfamiliar dimensions of otherwise well-known histories, such as the role that Hitler's homes and domestic image played in German politics of the 1930s. And more recently, I've explored what Hitler intended with all of that construction that he ordered in occupied Norway. I had an amazing dissertation advisor, Barbara Miller Lane at Bryn Mawr College, who taught me not to overlook the obvious. And the obvious is often not what you think. So she started me off on this path of thinking about what are the things that are missing and but in right in front of our eyes. So that's it.
And so was there anything in your background that sort of got you real interested in architecture, or was it something you just sort of slowly came to over time?
I actually started off studying as an undergraduate anthropology. I've always been really interested in the ways in which culture operates and how sometimes people sort of are on the outside of it or the inside of it. I think that comes from being in Canada and with parents who were immigrants. And I think, you know, like many immigrants, you know, struggling to kind of find their place in a new country. But I think that I became kind of interested in architecture and the culture sort of the profession, just kind of gradually. And you know, being curious about the world around us and how, you know, thinking about who's constructing it and how it's being constructed, and then also who's on the inside or the outside of architecture in terms of feeling comfortable in spaces and thinking about cities and the ways that they empower some people and disempower others. So I was really interested in power and how that plays out in architecture, whether it's you're talking about an empire or a living room. I'm not entirely sure how I, you know, I got there, but I think it was the thread is always thinking about the cultural side of things.
So now let's turn to this book specifically. And you've mentioned in your introduction, you've written a lot of different things. This is such a unique and interesting book in a lot of ways, which we're going to talk about over the next hour. But Norway, I feel like, is forgotten by a lot of people, both historians and sort of casual like history buffs when they think about World War II. So why Norway? And sort of walk us through the sort of origin story of this book.
So the origin story of this book, it actually starts by accident. That's actually how a lot of my books seem to start, where I am looking for one thing and I find something else and I can't stop thinking about the other thing that I found. So I was at the German Federal Archives in Berlin. I was researching another Third Reich subject, and I came across a file about Hitler's secret plans to build a city in occupied Norway. So I knew nothing about the Nazis building projects there. So of course, you know, being an academic, I go off to the library and I come home with a book on the history of Norwegian architecture, and, you know, very excitedly open it up and am disappointed to see that the chapters skip from 1940 to 1945. And I just, you know, I didn't believe that those years were blank, and that unwritten chapter, the missing chapter, turned into this book. But, you know, that makes it sound very straightforward. But in fact, it took me a while. Again, it was the same actually with Hitler at Home. I didn't plan to write that book, but you come across something and it won't let you go. You keep going back to it and digging a little more and digging a little more until you find yourself fully into a new project.
And so along the way, did you have any moments where you thought, well, maybe I'll just write an article or two about it, or maybe I'll just put it aside and get back to it later? Or did this project, at what point did you know this was going to be a book?
It was actually at a conference in Bergen on the Nazis' use of art in occupied Norway. I'd been invited to attend this this conference, and I said, well, this was after I had just found this document in the archives. And I said, well, you know, thanks very much for the invitation, but I actually know nothing about this. But by the way, you really should get someone to look into this, because I found, you know, and I told them about the document that I had found. And they really encouraged me like to come. They're like, well, no one else is going to do it. You know, why don't you come to the conference? And so I ended up, you know, preparing this conference paper and delivering it there among a group of amazing sort of Norwegian historians. And the conversations that developed around this just really encouraged me to go on and to tackle this as a book project. So it's conferences are so important, and I really miss them, I have to say, in COVID, exactly for that, because they're a place where you can test out your ideas and see whether in fact you do want to, so, you know, this is right for an article, or this is right for a book, or for something else. And so I'll always be grateful to that group for setting me on this path.
Now let's sort of take your book now. It's broken down into five chapters, all of which are very readable. And for many of our listeners, they will love to know there are lots of great pictures in this book. Really, really excellent use of graphics. So let's start with the real basics that you cover in the first chapter. How did Nazi Germany view Norway? How did they view Norwegians sort of culturally and racially? And sort of why did Hitler have such a fascination with Norway? You tell that the very interesting story of Hitler on the boat sort of touring up there in Norway. But then we'll start with that, and then I'll ask a couple of follow-ups.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about in the research is that I discovered that Hitler had been to Norway on a cruise in 1934. And that was something that I didn't, again, I didn't know about. And then discovered an album of negatives from that trip at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. So that, you know, that, again, one of these things that pulls you in and you just keep going deeper and deeper. So how did Nazi Germany view Norway? Well, in their notion of a racial hierarchy, Nazis placed Norwegians at its apex. So they were seen as being superior even to Germans in the purity of their so-called Aryan blood. And so they saw the Norwegians as really invaluable to their mission to purify Germany's Aryan population through selective breeding. So in order to convince Norwegians of their shared Nordic brotherhood and interests, Hitler courted them with propaganda and incentives, unlike the policies, you know, of mass extermination and slave labor that he deployed in Eastern Europe. Now, culturally, however, the Germans did not hold the Norwegians in the same high regard. I mean, they did believe that they shared a common Nordic culture, and they, you know, celebrated Norwegian artists such as, you know, the writer Henrik Ibsen or the painter Johan Christian Dahl. But they thought that culturally the Germans were more advanced than the Norwegians, as well as much more advanced politically, especially in their race consciousness. They thought the Norwegians were really lacking in race consciousness. The Nazis thought that Norwegians had fallen under some bad influences from England and the United States, and that their culture had degenerated and had to be reformed politically and culturally. So as the book explores, that actually has an impact on how Nazi construction projects played out in Norway. So we find a deep contradiction between those projects that are meant to bring Norwegians and Germans closer together and others that are meant to keep them apart. So it's very much like this ideology very much informs, you know, the projects that Hitler undertakes in Norway. And it's, you know, this contradiction is at the heart of them.
One of the things I noticed in that chapter was that there seems to be a sort of urban-rural divide sort of embedded in German thinking about Norway. They seem to have really disliked the cities, the urban architecture, which I think, as you point out in the book, that comes from these bad influences, right? And so can you talk to us a little bit about this sort of urban-rural divide in sort of German thinking? And I guess, does it fit into how the Germans sort of viewed themselves with this whole, like, all these Heimat culture and all that?
So there is this profound contrast in how urban and rural Norway are portrayed in Nazi propaganda. And that does reflect an ideological stance that goes back decades in Germany, but it takes on new meanings in Norway. So Oslo was the capital of Nazi-occupied Norway, and Nazi writers just lambast it as, you know, culturally degenerate. In their eyes, that degeneracy exists in the architecture. You know, the Nazis hate functionalist architecture, which dominates at that point the Oslo cityscape. They also see it in the Americanization of Oslo and you know, the attraction of young Norwegians to swing and jazz. They also see it in Oslo's women, interestingly, who are far too independent for Nazi tastes, and Nazi writers mock them as flappers who are obsessed with cocktail recipes and, you know, quote unquote Jewish psychoanalysis, and who have, you know, lost their sense of duty to the nation and folk. And finally, they also see that degeneracy in Oslo's left-leaning politics, which they want to crush. So there are all these various kind of elements to the degeneracy that they see happening in Oslo. Now, by comparison, rural Norway is portrayed as a place where the people are still connected to the land and to, you know, a healthy, in their view, Nordic culture, you know, where men are men and women are women and people understand their duty to the folk. And Nazi writers praise the traditional timber architecture of rural areas, which they see as authentic and beautiful compared to Oslo's inauthentic and ugly modernity, again, in their eyes. So this contrast is very stark. It draws on already sort of a well-developed conservative discourse in Germany, but is used by Nazi propagandists in Norway as a way to try to convince Norwegians that they're actually being saved by the Nazis from this kind of degeneracy. And for German readers reading about this, you know, it also rings a bell in terms of, oh yes, you know, this is familiar, this seems right. So it's taking something that's, you know, been tried in Germany, and this happens in other ways as well, and kind of twisting it so for it to, they hope, work in Norway. They do this, for example, with the autobahns too. Hitler plans to build an orders there to build an autobahn from Trondheim to Berlin, and in the propaganda around the autobahn, it's very similar again to the propaganda around the autobahns in Germany. So that, you know, the Nazi propagandists think that this will, they think it's worked in Germany, let's try it in Norway. And there are always, you know, two audiences. There are the Norwegians, and then there's the Germans back home who, you know, also have to be convinced of this new front that Hitler has opened up, which nobody was expecting.
Yeah, that sort of leads me to my next question about, and it's the second chapter of your book. Almost immediately after the occupation of Norway, the Germans sort of begin all of these massive infrastructure projects. And you touched on the two audiences already. But can you give us a little bit of a flavor of what the projects were, what they were hoping to achieve, outside of maybe convincing the audiences? And then we'll go from there.
There are all kinds of infrastructure projects. I mentioned the Autobahn. There's also a polar railway. There are new highways. There are airports. So there are all kinds of traditional ideas of infrastructure that, you know, we understand. And they focus on that partly because they want to bring Norwegian resources down to Germany. But they also think that Norway is a bit behind the times, and they want to bring it up to what they call the tempo of Nazi Germany. So they, you know, they want to improve its infrastructure. And that was something that they'd been actually looking at before they even invaded. But there's this other aspect of infrastructure that I talk about in that chapter, and that's the Lebensborn institutions, which started in Germany, but which just explode in Norway. And those are institutions that are meant, they are maternity and adoption homes, or orphanages, I should really say. And they're meant to encourage Norwegian women who have become pregnant with German soldiers to have their babies and not to abort them. And once they see, you know, just how many babies there are going to be, they create these institutions, Lebensborn institutions, and they start, bringing these babies down to Germany. And so I talk about that as a kind of pipeline on a cellular level. And it was, I know, kind of an unusual thing to bring into a chapter on infrastructure. But when you're thinking about the infrastructure of a racial empire, I think we have to think, you know, kind of beyond the traditional forms of infrastructure to think about what is the infrastructure that a racially based empire needs. And so that they're included in that chapter as well. And so there are many ways in which the Nazi architects and engineers are thinking about infrastructure. So what really struck me when I first started to look into this is that I found a map that was created by Allied intelligence of all the different construction sites. I think it's in 1942, the date of the map. And the country, you look at this map and the country is a massive construction site from top to bottom. And so the scale of the infrastructure projects is really just, unexpected. So what is Hitler, in a nutshell, trying to do with these architectural and infrastructure projects? Well, I mean, on the one hand, he's trying to, literally and figuratively build bridges to Norway's citizens to bring them into the fold of his greater German Reich. But at the same time, as I mentioned, the German occupiers are building an empire. One of the things that that really surprised me about those projects is that many of them are intended for the post-war period, when the Nazis expect to, reign supreme across Europe. So, I mean, people might be more familiar with the huge defensive structures that they built along Norway's coast. But what surprised me was, the plans for the post-war period. And so when we look to Norway, we see what Hitler and his architects, were planning for the world under the swastika, and that they had already begun to build it in Norway. We also see, how the Nazis imagine themselves in relation to the North, which is a place that's both physical and mystical for them. The Nazis never planned to leave Norway, despite public pronouncements to the contrary. And instead, they really saw the invasion of Norway as a homecoming. The Nazis believed that Germans had originated in the North and, were finally returning, and they were, through these projects, making the land their own again. So that building is central to this strategy of reappropriation. And that, makes sense if you think that, Hitler as a young man had dreamed of becoming an architect. And so it's not too surprising that later on it influences his methods of empire building. So, yeah, for all those reasons, then we just, the Nazis are putting an enormous investment in terms of infrastructure and architecture into remaking Norway.
Would you, just a little follow-up, would you make the argument that Norway was sort of a template for them, that they were going to see how it went in Norway with these projects and then sort of duplicate it elsewhere, both architecturally, mostly, I guess my question, mostly architecturally, they're going to sort of use this stamp in other places? Do you think that that was something that they thought about?
I think it's a template for those countries that they deem are worthy of partnership in the greater, in the greater German Reich, that are part of this Nordic brotherhood. It's clearly not the case for Eastern Europe, which is just, the approach there is just to wipe out peoples and cities, just tabula rasa. And in Norway, because they actually want to befriend the Norwegians, if you can believe this, they take a different approach. And so I do think it's a template, but for a specific, you know, subset.
Sure. Specific set of circumstances have to be met. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that's clear, because I know that I'm sure some of our listeners have probably read Catherine Epstein's book about Arthur Greisler, and it talks a lot about the sort of reconstruction of the Vardagal. And they're very different projects.
Yeah. they're the flip sides of each other so as the Nazis are thinking, for example, of, you know, erasure and eliminating, you know, in their mind, threats to the gene pool, they're also thinking about where they can appropriate things that will help them. So it's flip sides of, you know, their horrific project.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let's sort of switch gears a little bit and move on to your next chapter. Along with a lot of these infrastructure projects, Hitler had ordered the sort of the creation or building of recreational and cultural centers for German soldiers stationed in Norway. For statistical purposes, do you have a rough number of how many German soldiers were stationed in Norway throughout the war?
It varies, but the numbers are huge. So the highest number is over 400,000. It dips down after the invasion of the Soviet Union, but it's a very, very high number.
High number,
That's Norway's population is not that big. It's about 3 million then. So this is a huge number. And in some places where the German troops are concentrated, particularly the north, you know, military strategic places, sometimes they're in villages where they just swamp the inhabitants, where you have like a village of 200 people and you have 2,000 German troops who show up.
Wow. So what was the idea behind these cultural centers? Were these sort of specifically for German soldiers, or was it just another sort of, I guess, instrument to help, you know, bring Norway and Germans together?
Great question. So Hitler commissions 100 of these centers. They're called Soldatenheime. And a quarter of them were actually built. So these are, as you mentioned, cultural and recreational centers troops to spend their off-duty hours. And they're generously designed and furnished. They have theaters, you know, that show German films, restaurant pubs that serve German food and beer, and, you know, walls decorated with German art, you know, libraries with German books, and so on and so on. They're really these self-contained German worlds. And they are specifically for Germans, and specifically for, you know, the soldiers, and to try to reinforce their national identity in a foreign land. Norwegians are actually forbidden to enter them. So they're not a place where the Germans and Norwegians are going to come together. So these 100 planned Soldatenheime were, you know, to be located throughout Norway, but they were particularly needed, Hitler thought, in the north of the country. And, you know, this is a region that is in winter, cold and dark, and that affected soldier morale. They're often, as I mentioned, sometimes they were stationed in places that were tiny, tiny villages, and there's not a lot to do. So Hitler worried that German soldiers, you know, isolated in these northern reaches might lose themselves, might lose their sense of self. So the Soldatenheime were meant to be kind of pieces of the homeland. That's how they're talked about, islands of the homeland that are tethering the soldiers and keeping them German. And again, I found this so interesting because it starts to give us insight into how are you going to manage the greater German Reich? You know, how are you going to, as you know, the territory expands, how are you going to tether it and keep it focused on, you know, the homeland and on Berlin? So we start to see the ways in which German identity is being reinforced and protected.
I don't want to go too far afield from your book. I will readily admit it, this is something I knew nothing about, these recreational centers. Do you know if these were built in other occupied countries?
They were. And they actually go back as a model. They go back to World War I. And they were especially important from the Germans' perspective on the Eastern Front in World War I for very similar reasons, keeping, you know, German boys German. But what is unusual in Norway is that because the Norwegian population is so small and many of the, as I mentioned, the towns that the soldiers are in are so small, in these other countries like France, there would be you know, theaters or bars or restaurants that you could take over and turn into Soldatenheim. And that's what happens. But in Norway, you just don't have the building stock to do that. You don't have, you know, buildings that you can, you know, that can hold 1,200 or 1,300 soldiers, which some of these can. So they have to create a new building type in Norway. And they have to build these, even in these really remote locations. So Hitler gets very excited by this. You know, he always gets very excited about architectural projects. And so they develop building types that you can, they're prefabricated, and they are shipped, you know, depending, different sizes of Soldatenheim are shipped to these locations, and all the contents are shipped with them too. So it's an architectural experiment that we don't see in other locations. And again, you know, a sign of the kinds of, you know, new architecture that's going to be required for the empire.
I think throughout even just the beginning parts of our discussion, I hope the listeners are realizing that these are a lot of resources being put into Norway. Mm-hmm. You know, the shipping of these centers, you know, the prefab centers and the massive architecture projects. I'm hoping that people listening are getting a real sense of Norway was a really important place to the Nazis. And I know for a lot of people who maybe, you know, are just interested in World War II, Norway is sort of an afterthought for a lot of people who are interested in the war and sort of things. But I mean, you're really painting a picture of Norway in a very different way that I don't think a lot of people are familiar with. So let's turn now to my next question. It's about Albert Speer, mm-hmm. Hitler's favorite architect. He was sent to Norway, apparently, to rebuild 23 towns that were destroyed during the initial invasion. I want to ask about the towns and why, I mean, obviously these towns were destroyed, so that's why they have to be rebuilt. But what the plan was for these towns, and then to discuss the level of collaboration maybe between Speer and the Norwegian architects themselves. We'll start there and we'll go from there.
Okay. So Albert Speer doesn't actually get to go to Norway. He's very disappointed by that because Hitler gets nervous about the resistance there. And he tells him that, you know, he's just too valuable to risk. At least that's what Albert Speer goes around and tells everybody that his very modest way. But he's planning on it. And so the Norwegians actually start the process of reconstruction in the summer of 1940. So they begin the process, but the Germans soon take it over in order to shape the towns according to Nazi town planning principles. So it was Josef Terboven, the Reichskommissar for Occupied Norway, who reached out to Speer to ask him to oversee the rebuilding of these towns. Speer was enormously busy, so he assigned his second-in-command, Hans Stefan, an architect who managed Speer's Berlin office, to be the liaison with the Norwegian architects that they selected, although Speer did meet with them directly in Berlin as well. So the collaboration was actually quite intense, especially in the early years. So not only did Speer and Stefan select the architects to work on reconstruction, but Speer also invited them for a three-week study tour of Germany and Austria so that the Norwegians could familiarize themselves with Third Reich architecture and urban planning, and then bring those ideas back to Norway and adapt them there. So the Nazi desire to create model cities in occupied Norway reflects a longer preoccupation with urban planning for Hitler and his architects. And already in Germany in the 1930s, Nazi planners designed and built whole towns, you know, as basically stage sets for the performance of the Volksgemeinschaft, the racial community. And in occupied Norway, the Germans invest vast sums to create the physical preconditions necessary for a new social order, you know, which they believed could not thrive in just any built environment. So you really do need to kind of prepare the ground for this new order. So that's the reason why, you know, the Nazis insisted on overseeing the rebuilding of these towns, because they see them as the nuclei of the new order. And they felt that Norwegians were far too individualistic, and they needed, you know, new public spaces and new public rituals to cultivate a sense of community. And so in the schemes for the reconstructed town plans, we see them introducing marching squares and parade routes, as well as new architectural types such as, you know, Nazi party buildings, which is also meant to kind of reorient life towards the party. But what was surprising to me in these plans was the focus on embedding Nazi values into everyday lives and spaces. It's much less about monumentality and much more about just these stage sets that you live your life in every day. Speer was also open to incorporating Norwegian traditions into these schemes. So overall, this is a much more subtle approach to design than what we think of when we think of, you know, Speer's monumentalizing architecture, the Nuremberg Rally Grounds or the new Reichschancellery. And to me, this is much more terrifying because I think it would be harder to defend against that more subtle approach.
And was this approach, was this part of the thinking, was to sort of help to more speedily incorporate the Norwegians themselves into the German Reich. So if you sprinkle a little bit of Norwegian culture in and then have all these other subtle things that sort of get them in more of a Nazi way of thinking, was that part of the strategy? Was it that very intentional in that way?
I mean, the Norwegian architects are to some extent also pushing back, right? In terms of trying to want to bring their own perspective to this, and they try. So that's where, the Norwegian traditions are coming in. And that's what's interesting is that there's give and take, and Speer is willing to do some giving, but there are also limits to that. But these towns are really meant to change behavior, and they're meant to change really people's mindsets. And in the Hans Stefan's letters to Speer are really interesting because he talks about what I think was a common perception among Germans about Norwegians. They're really independent. They're stubborn. They don't have the kind of the mentality that they want in terms of reorienting them towards this life of, this communal life centered around the party. And so they think that they'll be able to change people's mindsets through these, through changing the way that they live. And so in terms of for example, one of the things that Speer insists that they change is that traditionally the church was, the focus of the town. And Speer wants them to get rid of the churches and instead make those central places the Nazi party building. So it's a very big change. And the Norwegians push back. And there's, some negotiation around that. But they're really the building blocks from the perspective of Speer, and Stefan. These are the building blocks for the new society. You can't build the new society on old foundations. Literally, you need new foundations for this new way of thinking.
Let's now transition to the sort of the last part of the book. The plans. So all of this is sort of, I guess, all the first four chapters, the infrastructure projects, the rebuilding of these small towns, sort of leading us to the building of a whole new city, a whole new sort of German city in Norway. Of course, it's accompanied with a naval base, which I think we should talk about them maybe separately. So it's the idea of the city first, and what the city was supposed to accomplish, where it was. And then I'll ask you about the naval base that's also there.
Well, if it's okay, I'll actually start with the naval base because it's sure. The reason yeah. why the idea of the city arises. So already in October 1939, so a month after the invasion of Poland, the Germans grow concerned that their naval bases are within England's blockade lines. And they don't want to repeat what happened in World War I when the Allied blockade cut off the maritime supply of goods to Germany with really devastating consequences. So Admiral Erich Raeder starts lobbying Hitler to establish a naval base with free access to the Atlantic. And they consider locations in Norway as well as actually in the Soviet Union. After the invasion of Norway, the plans for a major new German naval base developed very quickly. Now, alongside that, Hitler comes up with the idea for a brand new German city to be built nearby. And this city would service the base, but also act as a cultural beacon in the north. So Speer desperately wants to design the city. It would be the first one that he would have created from scratch. And he basically throws a fit to get Hitler to agree to give him the commission. So in the book, I explore, you know, the process by which they select the site on the Trondheim Fjord, which is south of the existing city of Trondheim, and the progress they make on construction. And I should add that these plans are top secret because they don't want the Norwegians to find out and realize that the Germans are never leaving. And one of the things I find so interesting about the new planned city, which was to be called New Trondheim, is the immense contradiction it represents. So it gets back again to this, what we were talking about earlier, about these contradictions. So despite the fact that Nazi propaganda proclaims Hitler's intentions to treat Norwegians as equals in the greater German Reich, you know, the plans for this new city, I mean, clearly expose, you know, a very different reality. This is a city that is intended for German residents and with institutions, including, you know, a museum and an opera house that are going to celebrate German culture. So like the Soldatenheime, but like on a much greater scale, the German rulers are keeping themselves apart again from the Norwegians. And to me, this indicates that the Nazis' future empire, as they envision it and are, you know, beginning to build it in Norway, is always going to be a place where the Germans, as rulers, stand apart and beyond all others, no matter what the supposed purity of their Aryan blood.
So you mentioned a couple of things. So where did this, how far did the city get along in the building process? Was it interrupted? Was the naval base, how critical was the naval base as the war went on too, I guess?
You know, like the Polar Railway that I mentioned, this is one of Hitler's favorite projects and he won't let it go. So he really pushes it, pushes the architects and the planners to keep going and going, you know, beyond the point that really they should have stopped. The they did get to work on the base, the naval base. Fortunately, it took them a long time to actually start building because they were having trouble finding a stable, in terms of the soil conditions, finding stable soil conditions. That area has, you know, tremors and is not really great for building something this large. So they take a long time to figure out where they can put this base and city. And that actually really saves saves the landscape there from more destruction because by the time they're really getting the construction underway, it's also getting harder in terms of just keeping up as, you know, especially Germany turns to total war at a certain point, which is when the project gets, it does, never gets canceled, it gets shelved until they can come back to it after they've won the war. After, you know, after Norway was liberated, all of that construction was pulled up and removed. Although you can still see signs of it. And today, the site of the naval base is actually a camping beach. And I went and, you know, to look and see what the landscape looked like and, you know, see what you could still see of the construction. And at one point I looked down at my feet and I realized that it is all of this crumbled building material, bricks and concrete that, you know, after, you know, nearly 80 years have eroded. And if you don't look closely, you know, you could just think that they're rocks or things like that, but it's actually made up of that naval base, a lot of that beach, now looking, of course, you know, like eroded into the landscape, but there are still, still signs, if you know to look for them.
Wow. That's amazing. And I want to, sort of, turn to now your use of sources in this book. You use a lot of very, very interesting sources, and you take the time to highlight them a little bit in the introduction. So if you can give us just a brief overview of the new sources that you used, sort of where you found them, and maybe some one or two things that you found really remarkable about them.
Okay, I'm going to try to keep this answer short because asking a historian about their sources is just
right.
Do you have an hour? Mm-hmm. So I traveled to archives, and this was an archival-based project, and I traveled to archives in Norway, Germany, and the United States. Most of these were public, but there was one very important private collection, and that was Hans Stefan's papers. So one of the challenges that I faced, I think is typical for archival research, which is just getting to, you know, the archives. The materials I used weren't digitized. So accessing them meant physically getting to the archives and then spending, you know, long days going through heaps of folders. And now I look back on that, you know, very romantically, because, you know, that is something that's become so much harder with COVID. Now, what was unusual was the vast size of the Organisation Tote collection, the main collection that I used at the National Archives of Norway in Oslo. This collection is so large that it took archivists a very long time, almost 70 years, to process just the mountain of documents left behind by Hitler's engineering division in Norway, which was responsible for much of the work that I explore in the book. So, I mean, this is not a typical situation for a historian. But it was a good challenge to have to get through tens of thousands of documents. Yeah. And it gives you a different perspective too, because a lot of that, you know, what was interesting to me was that there was so much material in there, and it was material that you don't often have. So, for example, with the Soldatenheime, there were a lot of problems constructing them because they are in these really remote places, and everything had to be shipped in crates. And, you know, I remember there are lots of letters going back and forth, just trying, you know, asking where's my shipment, and then one shipment arrives, and it's, you know, of all the chairs for a theater, and they've arrived with the wrong screws, so you can't actually put them together. And, you know, it gives you like a texture that is, I think, hard to often get from what remains. So one of the challenges was just, you know, figuring out how to weave that texture into the narrative without sort of maybe getting overwhelmed by it. So there were things, you know, it's always hard to leave things out, but, you know, you have to do that.
Yeah, that is one of the constant challenges of any projects like this, all the things that you want to put in, but they have to be left out, or the books would be, you know, 1,000 pages. So as a way to sort of conclude discussion of your book, I always like to ask, what are one or two things you would like people listening to you today and people who hopefully will pick up your book and read it to really take away from it, and not just take away from it, but to keep with them?
So there are a number of popular television shows right now that imagine what the world might have looked like if the Germans had won the war, such as Amazon's The Man in the High Castle. So if we look to occupied Norway, we see that the Nazis had already actually begun to build that world in the 1940s, and it was closer than we think to not having been an alternate reality at all. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I think we have to rethink our preconceptions of what a National Socialist built landscape looks like. And by the time the Germans arrived in Norway, Nazi ideas on architecture and power were shifting, and they were focusing more on everyday spaces. The occupiers' infrastructure projects also played a big role in Norway, and these kinds of projects tend to be less conspicuous as physical relics of the past. So we have to really pay attention to them in a different way. So in a nutshell, I think we have to get beyond the idea that monumentality alone defines the National Socialist built landscape.
So now that this book is done, it's out, people can pick it up and read it. What are you working on now? Are you still in Norway, or are you moving to other places?
Other places, but I don't know where exactly yet. So I am working on a cultural history of ghost towns, going back thousands of years and across many different countries to understand, you know, how we came to be obsessed with abandoned places. Today, tourism to ghost towns is an enormous global industry, and it obscures how weird it is that we want to travel to places of decay and abandonment. This tourism is also sometimes to places that are dangerous, such as the still radioactive sites around Chernobyl, which are attracting tens of thousands of sightseers these days. So I want to kind of understand that impulse and introduce a sense of strangeness to all of it, you know, if I can. And there are so many ghost towns that I'm going to have a hard time sort of picking which ones to focus on, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, that sounds like a really fun and interesting project. And hopefully when it's done, no pressure, when it's a book, I can have you back and we can talk about it, because I think that would be a lot of fun. I think people would really enjoy listening to you talk about it as well.
All right. I look forward to it.
Yep. I want to thank Despina for being on the show again. I really appreciate it. I really like this book. I really would encourage our listeners to go get it. Get a ebook copy for right now, maybe, or order it from Amazon. The title of the book is Hitler's Northern Utopia, Building the New Order in Occupied Norway. I also want to thank everybody for listening today, and we will see you all next time.